Okay, well, hello everyone. My name is Corey Fish, and I'm the president of the Madison Lawyers Chapter of the Federal Society. Thank you all for joining us this afternoon for our second panel of the Wisconsin Lawyers Chapter Conference. Today's panel focuses on the topic of nationwide injunctions. I had the pleasure of introducing the panel's moderator, Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Rebecca Bradley. But before I do so, a few housekeeping notes. First, the conference's keynote speaker is Senator Ron Johnson. He will be speaking tomorrow night at 5 p.m. at our socially distanced cocktail hour at the Ingleside Hotel in Pewaukee. You can register online, and I hope to see you all there. Second, if you would like to ask us a question of one of the panelists today, please use the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom screen and enter your written question at any time during the panel. Justice Bradley will moderate a Q&A session after the panelists' prepared remarks. Okay, on to the panel. I have the distinct honor of introducing Justice Rebecca Bradley today. She has been a great friend of the Federal Society and often takes time out of her very busy schedule to participate in our events. Justice Bradley is a Milwaukee native who was elected to the Wisconsin Supreme Court in 2016 after being appointed by Governor Scott Walker in 2015. Before joining the Supreme Court, Justice Bradley served on the District 1 Court of Appeals in the Milwaukee County Circuit Court. She's the first female Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice to have served in all three tiers of Wisconsin's court system. Prior to entering public service, she worked in private practice for almost two decades. She's a graduate of Marquette University in 1993 with honors, with a bachelor's in business administration and business economics, and she received her Juris Doctor from the University of Wisconsin Law School in 1996. She has previously served as the president of the Milwaukee Lawyers Chapter of the Federal Society. And Justice Bradley, with that, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Corey. First of all, I'd like to thank the Federalist Society for inviting me to moderate this panel on nationwide injunctions. Before I introduce each of our esteemed panelists, I wanted to set the stage a little bit for the topic we will be discussing. In Trump v. Hawaii, Justice Clarence Thomas questioned the authority of federal district courts to enter nationwide injunctions. In a concurring opinion, he wrote, "The district court imposed an injunction that barred the government from enforcing the president's proclamation against anyone, not just the plaintiffs. Injunctions that prohibit the executive branch from applying a law or policy against anyone, often called universal or nationwide injunctions, have become increasingly common. District courts, including the one here, have begun imposing universal injunctions without considering their authority to grant such sweeping relief. These injunctions are beginning to take a toll on the federal court system, preventing legal questions from percolating through the federal courts, encouraging forum shopping, and making every case a national emergency for the courts and for the executive branch." Justice Thomas continued, quote, "I am skeptical that district courts have the authority to enter universal injunctions. These injunctions did not emerge until a century and a half after the founding, and they appeared to be inconsistent with longstanding limits on equitable relief and the power of Article III courts. If their popularity continues, this court must address their legality," close quote. This panel will be discussing some of those issues, as well as what is the proper role of state attorneys general and the courts in litigation seeking to nullify federal law. Our panelists will discuss the difference in approach between Wisconsin during President Obama's administration and other states' efforts during President Trump's administration, with a particular emphasis on the role of state attorneys general and the role of the courts in issuing nationwide injunctions. Are nationwide injunctions, quote, legally and historically dubious, as Justice Thomas has described them? Our first panelist is Professor Michael T. Morley, an assistant professor at Florida State University College of Law. Professor Morley teaches and writes in the areas of election law, constitutional law, remedies, and the federal courts. He is best known for his work on election emergencies and post-election litigation, nationwide and other defendant-oriented injunctions, the jurisdiction of the federal courts, and their equitable powers more generally. The United States Supreme Court has cited several of his articles. He has appeared on numerous national and local news programs, and his work has been published in many of the nation's top law reviews. Before joining FSU Law, Professor Morley taught at Harvard Law School. He also served as Special Assistant to the General Counsel of the Army at the Pentagon and clerked for the United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit. During his tenure with the Army General Counsel's Office, he was awarded the Meritorious Civilian Service Award. He also worked in private practice in Washington, D.C. Our second panelist will be Misha Saitlin, a partner with Troutman Sanders, LLP. Attorney Saitlin has extensive experience litigating high-stakes appeals before the United States Supreme Court, federal courts of appeal, and state Supreme Courts. Attorney Saitlin leads the firm's national appellate and Supreme Court practice. He has served as an appellate advocate on high-profile appeals involving redistricting, regulatory takings, and environmental regulations. Before joining Troutman Sanders, Attorney Saitlin was Wisconsin's Solicitor General from 2015 to 2018. Before that, he served as General Counsel in the West Virginia Attorney General's Office. Attorney Saitlin also clerked for the Honorable Anthony Kennedy of the United States Supreme Court. Our final panelist today will be Attorney Jeffrey Mandel, a partner with Stafford Rosenbaum, LLP. Attorney Mandel serves as a counselor to businesses, nonprofits, municipalities, and individuals on how best to handle litigation risk and navigate administrative regulations. Attorney Mandel co-chairs Stafford Rosenbaum's litigation practice group and leads the firm's teams focusing on appeals and election and political law. Between November 2018 and October 2019, Attorney Mandel argued four cases before the Wisconsin Supreme Court, more than any other private practice lawyer in Wisconsin, joining Attorney Saitlin as one of our frequent flyers before the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Attorney Mandel has litigated in appellate courts across the country, as well as the United States Supreme Court. With that, I will turn the panel over to Professor Morley.
Great, thank you very much. And I'd also like to thank the Federalist Society for hosting this panel. As an initial matter, in framing the panel, the topic of conversation has been referred to as nationwide injunctions. And the very first thing that I would like to encourage everyone to do is to discard that terminology, because words, phrases like nationwide injunctions, universal injunctions, I would suggest complicate the matter by focusing our attention on the wrong aspect of the question, right? The issue isn't where geographically should an injunction apply, how broadly geographically should an injunction apply, but rather the main issue is how should the injunction be shaped? Whose rights should the injunction be focused on? So rather than having disputes over nationwide or universal injunctions, I've consistently suggested that we adopt alternate terminology distinguishing between what I refer to as plaintiff-oriented injunctions and defendant-oriented injunctions. A plaintiff-oriented injunction, consistent, as we'll discuss, with traditional notions of equity, with Article III principles, a plaintiff-oriented injunction is an injunction that is tailored and crafted to enforcing the rights of the plaintiffs before the court. A defendant-oriented injunction, in contrast, is an injunction that says, you government defendant, whether it's an official, whether it's an agency, you government defendant are prohibited from enforcing this challenged legal provision, whether it's a statute or a regulation, against anybody, anywhere in the nation. So the focus of a plaintiff-oriented injunction is enforcing a particular plaintiff's rights or the rights of the plaintiffs before the court, whereas a defendant-oriented injunction is typically what we think of when we're talking about nationwide injunctions, and it's telling the government defendant, you can't enforce this challenge provision at all. Now, one reason why I suggest the word or the phrase nationwide injunction is misleading is precisely because to protect a plaintiff's rights, it may be necessary to enjoin the defendant's conduct throughout the nation, right? The question isn't where geographically is the plaintiff safe, where geographically is the plaintiff protected from interference with its rights, but rather the question is whose rights should the court be enforcing? So with that terminological background, the question then becomes, so why should courts issue plaintiff-oriented injunctions? Why should courts issue injunctions tailored to enforcing the rights of just the particular litigants before it, rather than defendant-oriented injunctions? Again, what we often refer to as nationwide injunctions. Why are they bad? And I'd like to suggest a range of reasons: constitutional reasons, pragmatic reasons, rule-based reasons, structural reasons as to why courts should generally limit themselves to plaintiff-oriented injunctions. And notice, by the way, one other benefit of discarding this terminology about nationwide injunctions is if you have a federal court, or a state court for that matter, that invalidates a state statute, the same exact question arises. Some of the issues will apply a little bit differently in that context, but yet again, if you have a state or a federal court that strikes down a state legal provision, the question still remains. Again, how broadly should the injunction be tailored? Just to protect the rights of that particular plaintiff, or the rights of all other third-party non-litigants throughout that state? So most basically, the fundamental Article III rationale as to why defendant-oriented injunctions are improper is that plaintiffs lack standing to seek them, and courts coextensively lack jurisdiction to issue them. The Supreme Court has never expressly and squarely faced the issue of nationwide defendant-oriented injunctions. In a case called Perkins versus Lucan Steele from 1940, the Supreme Court struck down a defendant-oriented injunction, a nationwide injunction, against an administrative action of the Department of Labor. And one of the components of the court's reasoning was that the injunction goes beyond any controversy that may have existed between the complaining companies, between the actual litigants, and the government. By enjoining the Department of Labor's action against everyone throughout the nation, the lower court exceeded the bounds of the Article III controversy before the court. And I'm not going to bore you by reading through a lengthy string cite of court citations, but I do want to just throw two holdings out there. Califano versus Yamasaki from 1979, the Supreme Court held injunctive relief should be no more burdensome to the defendant than necessary to provide complete relief to the plaintiffs. So the court is expressly holding that the Constitution requires injunctions be tailored to enforcing the rights of the plaintiffs. And then later in Duran versus Salem Inn Incorporated, the Supreme Court said neither declaratory nor injunctive relief can directly interfere with enforcement of contested statutes or ordinances except with respect to the particular federal plaintiffs. And more broadly, I would suggest that the texture, the fabric of Article III standing jurisprudence is consistent with the notion that the scope of relief has to be tailored to redressing the harm that particular plaintiffs have suffered. This concept is fairly intuitive in most other contexts. For example, in a damages lawsuit, if there is a train accident in which multiple people are injured, if one particular rider brings a suit for damages, that rider, of course, has standing to seek compensation for the injuries that he or she has suffered. He can seek compensatory damages to make him or herself whole. But a federal court would say, you don't have standing particularly outside the context of a class action, right, in an individual action just by you as an individual plaintiff, you don't have standing to assert the rights of other riders on that train to seek compensatory damages on behalf of those other riders. They are third-party non-litigants. They're not before the court. You don't have standing to bring their claims, even though it's one incident, one accident, the same exact issues on liability. Nevertheless, no standing exists. We also would see that these principles clearly applying in the context of private litigation for equitable relief. If Apple were to sue Samsung, for example, for patent infringement, Apple would be able to get an injunction against Samsung, barring it from infringing on any of Apple's patents, Apple would certainly have standing to seek such relief. And importantly, such an injunction could apply nationwide or potentially even worldwide, right? If Apple were to sue Samsung for some reason in Wisconsin, right? Assuming personal jurisdiction and all that, Samsung couldn't evade the injunction by simply crossing state lines and infringing in another state, right? The issue isn't the geographic scope of relief, but rather, if Apple were to sue and were to say, we want an injunction enjoining Samsung from infringing anybody's patents, not just ours, federal court would say no standing, that you, Apple, don't have standing to assert the rights of third-party non-litigants who aren't before the court, who might not even be subject to this court's personal jurisdiction. And so these same principles apply in the context of equity suits against governmental defendants. So moving past the constitutional objection, secondly, as some of that earlier conversation might have suggested, allowing courts to issue defendant-oriented injunctions circumvents Rule 23. Right? Rule 23 provides a mechanism that allows a plaintiff to bring third-party and people who otherwise would be third-party non-litigants before the court. It allows for aggregate litigation. In fact, if you look at the history of Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 23b2, it was adopted during the civil rights era specifically to allow for enforcement, for constitutional and other civil rights type challenges so that all members of the community could benefit from a favorable ruling rather than just particular plaintiffs. So particularly since we have rules of civil procedure that expressly authorize these types of lawsuits, we have rules, Rule 23A, that lays out requirements, that lays out criteria that have to be satisfied in order to bring such third-party non-litigants before the court. Allowing courts to issue defendant-oriented injunctions is effectively a form of backdoor circumvention of Rule 23's restrictions. And this isn't just some theoretical objection, because a third deficiency, a third problem that arises with regard to nationwide or defendant-oriented injunctions is that they give rise to asymmetric preclusion, right? If a single plaintiff can seek a defendant-oriented injunction, a nationwide-oriented injunction against a governmental entity, then if that plaintiff wins, all right holders throughout the state or all right holders throughout the nation have their rights enforced. Whereas if that, so everybody gets the benefit, all right holders get the benefit of a favorable ruling. Whereas if that right holder loses, another right holder, another similarly situated right holder could bring the exact same claim, potentially before even the exact same court, as federal district court rulings don't give rise to a stare decisis effect, but more likely they would forum shop and bring their claim in an alternate jurisdiction. And plaintiffs can keep bringing the same cause of action over and over and over, potentially in different jurisdictions, until some judge somewhere rules in their favor, in which case then all right holders throughout the nation get the benefit of that ruling. So one of the unintended consequences of allowing defendant-oriented injunctions is that the stakes of the lawsuit are unfairly asymmetrically different. The government has to run the table. The government literally has to win every single case everywhere against everyone to be able to enforce the statute at all. Whereas if only a single right holder is able to prevail, that person, at least in the first instance, is able to get theoretically nationwide relief, completely invalidating the statute against everyone everywhere. I would also suggest that nationwide defendant-oriented injunctions are inconsistent with the decentralized hierarchical structure of the federal judiciary. Congress could have crafted the federal courts not as a series of distinct districts and a series of distinct circuits, right? They could have had the federal courts structured like the Federal Circuit, for example, where a single court has nationwide jurisdiction over constitutional issues, or where whichever court rules first automatically binds all other circuits throughout the nation. But we don't. District court rulings don't have stare decisis effect at all. Circuit court rulings, U.S. Court of Appeals rulings, don't have stare decisis effect outside of those circuits, precisely because both the jurisdiction as well as the stare decisis effect of each unit within our decentralized judiciary is limited. Nationwide injunctions, defendant-oriented injunctions, allow a single district court judge, potentially bolstered by two court of appeals judges, both of whom are judges on constitutionally inferior compared to the Supreme Court, tribunals of ostensibly limited jurisdiction, whose views only have stare decisis effect within limited areas, they're able to give their views, they're able to give their interpretations of the Constitution, the force of law for all right holders across the entire nation, potentially even despite contrary precedent from other circuits. From a more pragmatic perspective, allowing defendant-oriented injunctions promotes extreme forum shopping, where plaintiffs have an incentive to seek out across the entire nation the most ideologically extreme district court judge who is most likely to rule in their favor, which I would suggest not only can interfere with the ability of appellate courts to be able to exercise the same type of review they would then if you had these cases distributed across a more ordinary cross-section of judges, but moreover, it's going to skew constitutional law to the extent that highly charged controversial cases from one end of the spectrum or the other are tending to be funneled more to a handful of courts whose judges are then give their rulings binding law across the nation. This routinizes emergency litigation. If federal executive orders, federal statutes, federal regulations are invalidated across the entire nation, this triggers the need for emergency litigation. You have cutting-edge controversial issues being decided by the Supreme Court on an emergency basis, highly rushed, not well considered. As cases make their way up on an emergency basis, people's rights are being flipped on and off throughout the nation like a light switch. And I would also suggest defendant-oriented injunctions are inconsistent with the Supreme Court's holding in United States versus Mendoza, where the court rejected non-mutual collateral, offensive collateral estoppel against the government. The Mendoza court held that the government is entitled to relitigate cases. Defendant-oriented injunctions prevent the government from being able to relitigate issues in multiple jurisdictions. So from virtually every conceivable perspective you can think of, constitutional, rule-based, structural, fairness-based, pragmatic, nationwide defendant-oriented injunctions are bad.
Thank you, Professor Morley. Mr. Saitlin, you're up next.
Thank you, Justice Bradley, and thank you to the Federalist Society. Can everyone hear me okay? Great. Obviously I wish we were doing this in person, and hopefully I'll get to see many of you in person tomorrow at the socially distanced happy hour. Now, Professor Morley is one of the nation's leading experts on nationwide injunctions, and he's written about this before it was cool. So his approach is based on principle and not based on politics of the moment. So I am a little bit nervous in giving a presentation that largely disagrees with a good portion of what he says. But having said that, I am deeply concerned about the conversations that have been happening in federal society circles about this issue. And I'm concerned that we are losing the forest for the trees. Nationwide injunctions were necessary, absolutely necessary, to safeguarding the rule of law when state AGs, like the Wisconsin AG, secured many of them against Obama's overreach, and they will be absolutely necessary if the rule of law is to survive in the years going forward. They are within the authority of the federal courts, as I think almost everyone recognizes in at least several very important areas. And if carefully and thoughtfully implemented, they do not raise many of the practical issues that Professor Morley discussed. With all that in mind, I would like to make 2 points today. One, while the wholesale critique of nationwide injunctions is not only wrong, but potentially dangerous to our constitutional system of the rule of law, separation of powers, and federalism. And two, while the real problem with these injunctions, which I think is forum shopping and asymmetric preclusion can be addressed in certain practical ways that I think would be much better than the more drastic ways that some have suggested. First, on that general topic, I think it's important to know while you hear a lot of kind of high-level critiques of nationwide injunctions, most scholars and critics actually recognize that there are at least some very important areas where nationwide injunctions are permissible. The broadest category, and I think this one is an area of agreement among almost all critics of nationwide injunctions, is the one that we heard Professor Morley talk about here, which is 23B2 nationwide injunctions based on class certifications. In my respectful submission, the acceptance of this sort of injunction destroys most of the historical and many of the practical arguments against these injunctions. 23B2 is not in Article 3. It's not even in a federal statute. It's in the federal rules of civil procedure. And once one concedes that a single district judge, handpicked by a single plaintiff, can issue a nationwide injunction as long as they tick off these factors that were set up, not in the Constitution, not in a statute, but in a federal rule. I think this kind of moves the critique of nationwide injunctions from a high-level Article 3 principle box to a more practical box. But even putting Rule 23B aside, there are many other kinds of litigations that are not class actions, but still most recognized will lead to nationwide injunctions. Think about lawsuits brought against major actions by the federal government, brought by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, nationwide environmental groups. Those are not class actions, but most recognize that in order to give the U.S. Chamber full relief from an onerous nationwide regulation, the injunction would have to be nationwide because the U.S. Chamber has members all over the country, and the same would go for the Sierra Club. Further, another very large category where I think many folks recognize that you need to allow the equivalent of a nationwide injunction is in challenges to agency rules. That's because the structure that Congress has set up is that agencies can issue rules, but courts can set them aside when they're not in accordance with law. Now, there are very powerful critics of the administrative state in general, including Justice Bradley, that discuss why it's deeply problematic for agencies to be issuing things that look like laws. But as long as we are going to allow that kind of thing, I think the concomitant power for courts to set aside those agency regulations must be permitted, and it is specifically authorized in the Administrative Procedure Act. Further, other critics say that nationwide injunctions are appropriate when the federal actor is violating clear U.S. Supreme Court law. In that sort of circumstance, because the Supreme Court does state the law of the land, a lot of critics say, well, that would be an exception that would allow a nationwide injunction if, for example, the Supreme Court made one ruling and then the president issues an executive order just flouting that ruling. And then finally, another very important category is that most recognize where Congress sets up an exclusive jurisdiction to challenge a certain kind of government action, nationwide injunctions are appropriate. Perhaps the most prominent example of this is that Congress for many agencies has set up the DC Circuit as the exclusive jurisdiction to review nationwide rules. For example, the Clean Air Act rules of nationwide scope. And I have not seen many arguments that if there is a DC Circuit lawsuit brought against, say, the Clean Power Plan or the ACE rule, that somehow only the individual challenging that rule should get relief, and everyone, there would need to be 20, 30, 100 duplicative petitions for review brought in the DC Circuit, given that there is an exclusive jurisdiction set up by Congress. So given that we have, I think, many examples of almost universally accepted nationwide injunctions, I think the question is more a practical one, is should we encourage these in appropriate circumstances? And to get at that, I want to gauge the temperature of those in the room. I'm gonna throw out a hypothetical executive action, which I think, given today's tenor, is not too hypothetical. I heard Vice President Biden say the other day in an interview that if the, quote, scientists told him it was necessary to control the coronavirus, he would, quote, shut the country down. And I take Vice President Biden at his word. I take it to mean that if the scientists told him that if he wins the election and the virus increases in the winter, as some say, he will issue a nationwide executive order locking down the country with a phased lockdown approach, with a reopening as, you know, his CDC determines. And perhaps this won't look too different from the executive order or the rule that the CDC issued yesterday, a remarkable rule saying that under the CDC's power, we cannot have any more evictions in this country for the rest of this year. That I would respectfully submit that if that those kinds of orders are issued to require the bringing of 100 million lawsuits for every person whose rights are violated by these kinds of illegal orders would be destructive to the rule of law. And you know, to the extent that one floats these hypotheticals and conversations I've had, usually you get a back into, well, you know, if this kind of thing issues, obviously there would be a class action or many different class actions issued. But again, that doesn't really address the problem, because that would still be a handpicked district judge by smart plaintiff's attorneys who would come together and say, we're going to go challenge the Trump CDC executive order in California in this particular district. Or we're going to challenge the Biden executive order in Texas in this particular district. And this isn't just hypothetical, because we have seen what happens when courts do take some of this seriously. When I was Solicitor General of the state of Wisconsin, the Obama administration issued a quite clearly illegal rule, drastically expanding the jurisdiction of the EPA over the waters of the United States under the Clean Water Act. And what happened is that folks started bringing lawsuits all over the country challenging this illegal rule. And some judges, many judges, recognized that this rule was illegal, but they were convinced by these arguments against nationwide injunctions. So what we ended up with is a quite ridiculous situation where this rule that was specifically designed to operate nationwide, because of course waters flow across state lines, was enjoined in some states and not others, in some cities within some states and not others. There is no way that the agency could have ever even adopted a rule like that kind of patchwork rule consistent with the APA's arbitrary and capricious limitations. But as a result of, I think, an over enthusiasm for the arguments against nationwide injunction, we ended up with the de facto water policy in the United States, where one set of rules applied in one state versus another state, one county versus another county. And that would be, I think, the logical consequence of a really robust application of the no nationwide injunctions principle. Now, with all that having been said, I do think there are important problems with nationwide injunctions, and those relate to do with forum shopping and this non-mutual collateral estoppel point that Professor Morley raised. It is certainly problematic and troubling that whenever the government issues a broad rule, it has to basically run the table. And worse still, that a particular judge ruling that it's illegal would be rendered completely meaningless if another judge ruled it illegal and issued a nationwide injunction. And I think there are two levels of solutions to this problem. One is, I think, a measure of judicial modesty, is that judges should think about if there are cases pending in other courts that they should, as a matter of respect, try to limit the geographic scope of their injunctions. For example, one very beneficial trend that's been happening recently is that courts of appeals have been limiting injunctions issued within their court of appeals to just their court of appeals borders to stop the corrosive effect of not allowing percolation of these issues to continue. I think that is a good use of judicial modesty and judicial restraint that can protect rights broadly, safeguard our separation of powers and our rule of law, while not ruling more broadly. But I also understand that judicial modesty, you know, can be sometimes honored in the breach. So I do think that it is important for us to consider more global reforms. You know, in Wisconsin, we have this great system of original actions. For truly important statewide issues, we can go right to the state Supreme Court, who will decide the issue for the entire state. Perhaps the U.S. Supreme Court couldn't handle that kind of volume for how many important issues might be brought up, but perhaps more statutes could be enacted, like the statutes that have been enacted that give the DC Circuit exclusive jurisdiction over nationwide Clean Air Act rules that will allow issues of nationwide scope to be pushed into a particular court where all interested parties could come, could get a fair resolution, and then that case could be then teed up to the U.S. Supreme Court. That, I think, would address most of the practical problems of forum shopping and also non-mutual collateral estoppel, and would lead to a better system. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shatlin. Attorney Mandel, you're up next.
Great. Thank you very much, Justice Bradley. And I, too, would like to thank the Federalist Society for inviting me today. It's a pleasure to be here. And it's always good to get to talk with folks. Perhaps in some tension with the design of inviting me, I have to start by saying that I agree with Misha in most respects. That's not always the case, but it is here. I think, as Misha said, that nationwide injunctions are frequently necessary, and he gave some important examples. And I would agree with that. I think that there are, I'm going to focus my remarks, because we do agree so much, on some of the latter part of what Misha said about policy ways to address those legitimate concerns that do exist about nationwide injunctions. And I'd like to go back to where Justice Bradley started in quoting Justice Thomas, right? We have concerns that these kinds of cases prevent percolation and the input of judges around the country, that they encourage forum shopping, and that they create national emergencies. I think all of those things are valid concerns. And so the question is, how do we address those without getting rid of the important role that nationwide injunctions can and do play? I think that we can do that in a number of ways. You know, Misha talks about the idea of centralizing matters in the DC Circuit or some other kind of specialized court. And I think that would help. It would sort of focus and funnel those actions, but it would create other consequences as well, including making confirmation battles for the DC Circuit even more intense than they have been over the last 20 years or so. I think we could look at other kinds of solutions. We can look at some of what we've learned in how we handle class actions and maybe even multi-district litigation. And we could create a panel of federal judges and try to prevent forum shopping by assigning judges to the panel overall, and then saying that when cases like this are filed, they are randomly assigned to someone on that panel. What we've learned in the last 6 months by necessity is that we don't really need people showing up in courthouses in person to litigate a lot of these questions that are usually purely questions of law. And so it wouldn't really matter where the lawyers are. We don't need to worry about geography as much. Would also provide a way to consolidate when there are multiple cases to deal with some of the concerns that Professor Morley raises about the government having to run the table and there being multiple lawsuits. What we see in a lot of these matters, of course, is that these high profile issues that need to be litigated are litigated in multiple states or multiple courts simultaneously. And there is a concern that it's not fair that you need one plaintiff to win, but the government has to win them all for it to matter. So I think that those are the kinds of things that we could do to solve this. I will note that, like Misha, I'm a practicing attorney. I am not a scholar. And so it is with great trepidation that I step into a debate with someone like Professor Morley. But I have to say that I think that focusing entirely on the class action mechanism as a rationale overlooks something important, and that is the Federal Declaratory Judgment Act. The Federal Declaratory Judgment Act was adopted less than a century ago, but not much less than a century ago, I think precisely with the idea of allowing some of these kinds of issues, with the idea of allowing people to step in and litigate pressing matters in a broader way. And I think that because of the way declaratory judgments work, it makes it a lot more complicated. I understand why Professor Morley wants to focus on plaintiff versus defendant focused injunctions or oriented injunctions, but it's a lot more complicated because one of the things we all know about the Declaratory Judgment Act is it kind of jumbles up who the plaintiffs and who the defendants are. It gives people who would normally be defendants the ability to be plaintiffs. And so it becomes a lot harder to focus in that particular way. I would also note that Professor Morley used an interesting patent example. And he talked about what would happen if Apple and Samsung had a patent dispute. It is correct that Apple cannot sue Samsung and seek to vindicate not only its own patent rights, but those of others. However, if Apple and Samsung get into a patent fight, what we all know is that one of the things that is almost certain to come up is that Samsung is going to seek to invalidate Apple's, they're going to try to invalidate each other's patents, right? These are dueling patents. And if one of the patents is declared invalid, it's invalid against everybody. It's not just invalid. If Samsung's patent is invalid, it's not only invalid to be enforced against Apple. If a court holds that Samsung's patent is invalid based on Apple's litigation efforts, it's invalid across the board. And so I think that that actually shows that there is something, there is a fundamental underpinning to these nationwide injunctions that is entirely consistent with the way we understand traditional litigation. And so our goal should be to look at ways that we can mitigate and minimize the downsides that have been identified with nationwide injunctions without throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Thank you, Mr. Mandel. I'd like to remind the audience of the Q&A function in Zoom. It's toward the bottom right of your screens. You can pose a question. I'm the only one who will see those questions, and I will read them to the panelists or panelists to whom they are directed. While we're waiting for questions to come in, I'd like to give Professor Morley an opportunity to respond to the arguments made by the other two panelists. In particular, are nationwide injunctions necessary to preserve the rule of law, Professor Morley?
Great. So in thinking about some of the types of injunctions that have been put forward as examples of why we need nationwide injunctions, I would suggest that if you think about this in terms of plaintiff-oriented injunctions versus defendant-oriented injunctions, many of the examples that were brought up were simply variations of plaintiff-oriented injunctions, right? Most basically in a Rule 23b2 case. The whole point of going through the class certification process is to take right holders who would otherwise be third-party non-litigants, who would otherwise be strangers to the litigation, and bring them within the litigation, make them actual parties to the litigation. There's some potential debate over this in the context of a 23b2 case where they don't get notice or an opportunity to opt out, but at least the theory of a class action case is if the plaintiff class loses, then that judgment would be binding not only on the named plaintiff, but on all the right holder, on all the unnamed members, so you don't get the issue of asymmetric preclusion. So yes, I take the point that it's somewhat arbitrary, it's somewhat formalistic to say under the rules of procedure, right, we have this broad joinder type rule that allows for class members to be joined to the litigation, but that dividing line between being a litigant versus being a third party non-litigant, I would suggest is an essential Article III constraint on the judicial power. It distinguishes those before the court, those within the court's jurisdiction, as opposed to strangers. The same thing with associational standing. And I would suggest that that is a perfect example for why issuing plaintiff-oriented injunctions is the proper role for a court. Precisely because if you have an organization that goes before a court, or even if you have a state represented by its attorney general that goes before the court, the question is, what is the scope of relief that you need to redress the threat or the harm to your rights? And if you can show that enforcement against anyone anywhere would somehow undermine your rights, which is the case, for example, with some voting rights organizations where they spend time and money and resources helping register people to vote or helping ensure people turn out to vote. They often go through the effort of trying to establish that enforcing a challenged voting law against any voters actually would harm their institutional interests, would harm their organizational interests. And so therefore they assert standing to seek to challenge enforcement of the law, not just against them, but against the public that they spend resources and spend time serving. And so if courts are limiting themselves to plaintiff-oriented injunctions, the question then becomes, what scope of relief, how broad of relief do you need to redress the harm to your own rights? I obviously agree with the point that 100 million lawsuits is bad, but you don't need 100 million lawsuits to challenge federal action, right? An injunction is not the only tool in a federal court's toolbox, right? Precedent, stare decisis is just as powerful. Once a circuit court rules, that ruling then becomes binding throughout that circuit. Lower courts are bound by it. Right holders, if they needed to, could go to court and get a TRO enforcing it. So essentially, once the circuit court rules, it eliminates the need for emergency litigation throughout the rest of that jurisdiction, because as a matter of stare decisis, rather than as an injunction, that circuit court's ruling settles the issue, at least for right holders within that area. And so the question then arises, if you have ostensibly coordinate courts, equal district courts, equal circuit courts, if you have a district court or a circuit court that upholds the law within its geographic area, why should the ruling of an ostensibly coordinate court, an ostensibly co-equal court in a different place striking down the law, take precedence and allow it to enforce its view of the law across the nation?
We have some questions that have come in. I think the first question is probably directed more to attorneys Saitlin and Mendel. It's a lengthy one, so bear with me. Do courts have an obligation to define the scope of an injunction, or is it assumed that when a governing agency is the defendant and its regulations are at issue, that the agency is prohibited from enforcing them against non-parties as well? Even if this applies to the agency, are private parties able to still rely on those regulations as a defense in private litigation not involving the government?
Jeff, you want to give it a shot?
Sure. It's a super interesting question. I guess my first answer would be to say that courts do have an obligation to define the scope of an injunction. The Federal Rules of Civil Procedure are pretty clear about the obligations that courts have for injunctions to be clear. So while I think that a case that challenges government overreach does that there are strong reasons, as we've all discussed and Misha's really sort of spelled out, I think there are strong arguments for that case to have nationwide effect, but I don't think it has nationwide effect unless it's clear that the court intends that, because Rule 65D requires that injunctions be very clear and give everyone notice of exactly what is enjoined.
Attorney Saitlin, do you wish to add anything to that?
No, I think Jeff covered that really well.
Can I jump in on that briefly?
Please. Thank you.
So there was an interesting case that actually involved numerous state plaintiffs where they sued in Texas challenging a Department of Labor overtime regulation. And the Texas District Court held that the regulation was invalid, purported to issue a nationwide injunction prohibiting the Department of Labor from enforcing it against anybody anywhere in the nation. up in New Jersey, an employee of, I believe it was Chipotle, sued Chipotle for violating the overtime regulation. That employee, that plaintiff in the New Jersey litigation, was then the target of a contempt motion before the Texas court. And the Texas District Court wound up holding that plaintiff in contempt. That by bringing a lawsuit up in New Jersey, private lawsuit just between the employee and the employer, by bringing a lawsuit under the regulation that the Texas District Court had not only held unconstitutional, but had entered a nationwide injunction against, that employee was acting in concert with the Department of Labor, according to this district court, and therefore was in contempt of its injunction. The Fifth Circuit, luckily, thankfully, correctly, overturned that ruling and said that the simply invoking a regulation did not constitute acting in concert with an agency. And so notwithstanding the lower court's injunction, there were nationwide injunction, defendant-oriented injunction prohibiting DOL from enforcing its regulation, since it was still on the books at the time, private litigants in other jurisdictions could still continue to rely on it.
Yeah, this seems to be a perfect example of Misha invoked judicial modesty before, and the importance of courts being very conscious of their institutional role, and that seems like a perfect example where the district court perhaps missed the point, and the Fifth Circuit stepped in.
Our next question is directed to Attorney Saitlin. What do you think of Attorney Mandel's idea of having a panel of random judges assigned to decide a particular question? Would that be sufficient to deal with the problem of forum shopping, or do you see any other issues with that proposal?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, interesting. The way that it's done under certain federal statutes is that everybody has a certain window, usually 10 days, to file a petition challenging a certain regulation, and then it gets put into a lottery, and it gets lotteried to one of the courts of appeals where a petition has been lodged. I think that is a good system. I think the most troubling thing to me with nationwide injunctions is really the mismatch between the power of the injunction and how many, district courts there are out there and district judges there are out there. And I think a lot of these kind of quirky results, like the one that Professor Morley just mentioned out of Texas, are as a result of that. A system where the lottery happened at the Court of Appeals level, where you have a three-judge panel of appellate judges for any nationwide case, I think would have the best of both worlds. It would not centralize everything in the D.C. Circuit, and I definitely understand Jeff's concern about ramping up the temperature on the confirmation process, but it would still lodge these highly important decisions that might have nationwide effect in a randomly selected court, that time being one of the courts of appeals. And that could be a way to kind of split the baby between our two suggestions.
Can I respond to that?
Yes, I was struggling to find my unmute button.
So you couldn't do it in the Court of Appeals level, of course, right? Because a lot of these cases require fact-finding, right? Require discovery, require in-person testimony. So then the question becomes, should we do it at the district court level? And that was how constitutional litigation occurred throughout the bulk of the 20th century, starting with constitutional cases where people sought preliminary injunctions against state laws in 1910, and then expanded through the 1920s, and ultimately during the New Deal in 1937, Congress enacted a statute saying that if you wanted to challenge the constitutionality of a federal law, the case had to go before a three-judge district court with direct appeal as of right to the U.S. Supreme Court. And as early as 1910, these three-judge district court panels were required to hear ever expanding groups of constitutional challenges against state statutes. And ultimately, Congress abandoned this structure for constitutional litigation in the late 70s precisely because, number one, it was unwieldy, it slowed constitutional litigation down dramatically, and having then these three-judge panel rulings be directly appealable to the U.S. Supreme Court wound up overburdening the court's docket, where the court itself was pushing Congress to cut back on that jurisdiction and have it just be remanded to the ordinary, you know, tripartite appellate review structure subject to the court's discretionary certiorari jurisdiction. So any sort of attempt to reconfigure constitutional litigation going forward, I think needs to take into account the practical experience that we had with this, particularly throughout the mid 20th century. And I would suggest since that point, the range of constitutional litigation, and certainly if we were to expand this into APA challenges for clean water matters, certain other types of issues that we've been discussing, it would dramatically overburden the federal courts, right? Even with the judicial panel and multi-district litigation, that, and you know, obviously the JPML centralized judge is able to wield tremendous influence, and some might say is able to strongly encourage, if not strong arm, settlement. But at least structurally, that is only supposed to be for pretrial matters, right? At least in theory, then the cases do get shopped back out to their originating jurisdictions for trial proceedings and final judgment.
Sure. Go ahead, Misha.
So, well, I will say what the professor said there is a very important context. And I'll take a step back even further. A lot has changed since the beginning of the 20th century. And the biggest change, I would say, in our constitutional structure as a practical matter is that the executive branch now issues executive orders and rules that are basically statutes. And any cutback on the authority of the federal judiciary to check that, and including to issue nationwide injunctions, or at least injunctions for the circuit, it's a zero-sum game. The result of any cutback like that would be an even more drastic expansion of the power of the executive branch. So when one is thinking of where one wants to fall on this debate, and I think that you see from this debate that there are a reasonable range of views, I think where it's really going to cash out is, the more you are against nationwide injunctions, the more you're going to end up favoring executive power, and vice versa. And so just the question one should ask is which design will be more consistent with the original meaning of the Constitution?
I'm going to circle back to allow Professor Morley to respond to that, but first, Attorney Mandel.
Go ahead. I'm just going to add a quick practical point, which is, you know, while I will take Professor Morley's point that we have cut back on these three-judge panels, we haven't really abolished them. I mean, this is how we deal with redistricting litigation. And we have plenty of it, and it seems to be working pretty well. That, you know, in federal courts, challenges to apportionment and redistricting are heard by three-judge panels with direct review by the U.S. Supreme Court. And so it might be that we want to look at doing that for some other circumstances. I would also note that if in the 1970s the Supreme Court was overburdened with appeals from special three-judge panels like that, that's not necessarily the case today. The Supreme Court in the 1970s was issuing twice as many merits decisions as it is now. And so we might think about what that overburdening looks like, because the concern is not necessarily about the court's workload, it's about transparency and it's about percolation really within the Supreme Court. Because what's happening now as a result of the national emergency part of the nationwide injunctions is that we have a tremendous amount of stuff shifted to the court's shadow docket and being decided on motions for stays or motions to lift injunctions rather than on full merits briefing and adjudication. And so I don't think it's that the Supreme Court's not doing the work. I think it's just about how they do the work and how much people get to understand what's happening.
Professor Morley, are nationwide injunctions necessary to check executive overreach or unconstitutional exercises of executive power?
Well, they're certainly not necessary, right? As I had mentioned before, The scope of an injunction is not the only way of protecting third-party non-litigants. You can either bring them within the lawsuit, make them parties in class actions, in which case then the real question isn't what's the proper scope of relief, but how broadly should the class be defined? And that's a separate topic. I would suggest that rather than having nationwide classes, you should have circuit-wide classes or district-wide classes. But beyond that, there's precedent, there's stare decisis. When the Supreme Court issues a ruling, right, no one asks what is the scope of the injunction, right? The Supreme Court precedent acts as the law of the land within a circuit. When the circuit issues a ruling, you don't need an accompanying circuit-wide injunction. That circuit precedent has stare decisis effect throughout the circuit. And one compelling question I would suggest is, if we acknowledge that circuit precedent should only have stare decisis effect within that particular circuit, why should we then want to nevertheless have an accompanying injunction go far beyond that across the entire nation? And I would conclude by simply suggesting that this isn't just a matter of personal preference about how comfortable do you feel with executive authority and how much do you want to limit executive overreach. At the end of the day, if Article 3, as the Supreme Court for nearly a century has reiterated, if Article 3 specifies that a plaintiff only has standing to assert its own rights, that going beyond trying to assert the rights of other people, certainly trying to assert the rights of third-party non-litigants, is outside the scope of the case or controversy before the court, then it's really less a question of how much do you want to check the executive branch than are we going to twist and stretch and ultimately violate these Article 3 restrictions in the name of these injunctions? And I would suggest that we shouldn't.
We'll give our out-of-state guest the last word as we are now out of time. I'd like to thank each of our panelists, Professor Morley, Attorney Saitlin, Attorney Mandel. This was a terrific panel and a terrific discussion on a particularly compelling issue of the moment. So thank you again for your participation, and thank you to everyone who joined us to listen in and pose questions to the panelists.